Hey there, coming to Pendleton, Oregon, Saturday, June 29th, it's Jackalope Jamboree, featuring American Aquarium, Shane Smith and the Saints, Lily Hyatt, Carson McCone, Pete Krebs, and Jamie Wyatt, plus Tyler and the Train Robbers, Bart Budwig, James Dean Kendall and the Eastern Oregon Playboys, the Lonesome Billies, and more. Taking place across two stages at Pendleton's historic Happy Canyon Arena, located in Northeast Oregon. It's a full day of live music paired with local food, craft, beer, and wine. Camping and RV spaces available too. Tickets on sale now at jackalopejamboree.com, and our listeners can get 15% off their ticket order by entering promo code WALKINGTHEFLOOR. That's jackalopejamboree.com, promo code WALKINGTHEFLOOR. Get on it.
This is Parker Millsap, and you're listening to Walk the Floor. Walking the floor. God damn it.
Perfect. That's a keeper.
I'm Parker Millsap, and you're listening to Walking the Floor. How about that?
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor. I am back home from tour. I'm back home from my whirlwind Ireland, UK, Scandinavian tour, where we didn't sleep, we drove a lot, we flew a lot, we ate a lot of shitty gas station food, and we played the best goddamn rock concerts of my entire career as a solo performer. God damn, thanks to everybody that came out to those shows. That was seriously the most fun. This is the best that it's ever been for me, like going out and doing my own thing. It's fantastic, fantastic. Can't wait to come back. I hope I get back over there sometime this year because it was just endless, endless good fun. Even though we, you know, there was drama. We argued with the Norwegian Air backdrop people. But we made it to where we were eventually going, Stockholm or whatever that day, with all of our stuff. On the way back, I will tell you that American Airlines somehow sent all my guitars, all our guitars, to New York instead of Los Angeles. Not just one little punch in the old nuts from the airlines just to make you remember that you're on tour and you're at their mercy. Yeah, and you know, there was a little blowback on my social media feeds this week from some people that got offended that I made some disparaging remarks about our dear President Trump in some interviews over there. But I was kind of thinking about this, like, I get it, that's fine. Like, if I say something you don't agree with, feel free to criticize me. You know, I got my worldview, you got your worldview. We all got our own ideas and thoughts about how politics should work and all that sort of thing. And I'm, you know, hey, that's all good, that's how it works. But if you followed me at all over the years, and you followed my social media feeds, you followed my work or whatever, are you really surprised that I'm not a Trump supporter? I mean, come on. Come on. Oh, cue the faux outrage. Anyway, I should remind you that pre-orders for my new record, Hard Lessons, coming out June 14th, are available through my website. You can get like bundles, bandanas, and t-shirts and stuff, or you can just like pre-order it in the iTunes store or Amazon.com, you know, wherever you want to get your pre-orders. It is available and coming soon, and there's a couple of tracks up in Spotify and Apple Music and all that stuff, so you can check it out and see what you're getting into, okay? Hard Lessons, June 14th. Unless you're in the UK, then it's June 21st. All right, let's pay some bills. D'Addario. Did you know that support for Walking the Floor comes from D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories? They are committed to sustainability through the Playback Program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback Program and how to help in its mission of reaching 2.5 million strings in 2019, please visit playback.daddario.com. And while you're at it, go on over to Zounds.com. That's Zounds with two Z's, people. Zounds.com, where every order over $599 and above is eligible for their exclusive 12-part payment plan. With no application process and no interest charged ever. That's Zounds.com. Calm. Come on, let's get to today's interview. You know, sometimes with this podcast, I get a little backlogged, and I don't even realize it, and I've got like all these interviews sitting in the can that I haven't put out yet. And right now is one of those times. I feel like I owe Parker Millsap a little apology for lagging so hard getting this interview out there, because it was a great interview. And when I sat down to edit it and listen back to it the other day, I realized I interviewed him at the beginning of November. So whatever we talked about, he's probably done a world of other things since then. But at this time, he was had just been in LA on tour, and he was getting ready to go out and do another tour, like just solo, just him and an acoustic guitar. So we talked a lot about that, like sort of the differences with being a solo artist and then being, you know, or taking out a band. And we talked about thumb picking exercises, which he has some very good tips on. And we also talked about the sort of the pressure that having somebody like Elton John tag you as, like, you know, the guy saving music. I think Elton John said something about him, like, you know, he's restored my faith in music or something like that. And whether or not that kind of messes with your head when you're going into to be you in the studio. But he, like I said, my apologies to Parker for taking so long to get this up there, but I hope you enjoy it now. This is Parker Millsap on Walking the Floor. So how were you shows over the weekend?
It was great. It was great.
You were here in LA?
Yeah, we did Moroccan Lounge the last two nights. So we did two nights. It was great.
LA is like, it's a tough market.
Yeah.
Often.
It's so big.
Yeah. And it's so overrun with options, you know. Do you find you have good shows out here? Like, do you always get out here on tour?
Not always. This is like our second or third time to LA. So it's still pretty new for us.
Like I find doing this podcast based out of here that lots of, you know, Americana and country artists never make it out west.
Yeah.
Which is a strange thing to me, because, you know, California, I know it's a long time ago, but like it right. has such a great history of country music and right. roots music and everything, you know, and it just seems like it's not on the circuit.
It's just a long way to drive for a lot of bands.
Like touring the West Coast is a bitch.
Yeah, yeah. It like is. Until you get to a certain level and can sell so many tickets, it's just like, well, we can drive 4 days and make $100.
Right. Yeah. Tell me, nobody knows that more than me.
Yeah. Done a lot of those.
Are you? When did your latest record come out? Like, are you in the middle of a tour cycle right now?
Yeah, we're kind of at the end of big phase one for this record. The record came out in May, so we've been touring since then on the record, and we're about to take a little breather before next year.
What happens in phase two?
More touring. The same, just more of it in different places.
Do you like touring? I mean, you know, music business nowadays, touring is the brunt of it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like sitting in the van, but I love playing music every night. You know, like, I can't complain about that.
Do you mostly go out as like a headliner, or do you go out, or do you do both? Do you go out and support?
Yeah, for a long time we did a lot of support, but lately we've been going out and just headlining smaller rooms, and I really like it. I like getting to do a full 90 minutes, because, like, we've got ballads, we've got rock and roll songs. We can really get all of them in the 90-minute set.
I saw that you're doing some solo shows coming out.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a ton of solo shows. And I'm happy to say that I was always terrified of that dynamic. And I've really, like, kind of fell in love with it in the last few months.
Oh, good.
And I, in listening to your early records, I was wondering if that's like, is that kind of how you started? Did you start out more just like a guy on stage with a guitar alone kind of thing?
Sort of. Like, I started out really playing music in church, like every Sunday, like down front, just like they wouldn't even plug me in, but they'd let me, you know, play. But then I had, like, you know, rock and roll garage band in high school. And we played some gigs, but then after high school, I like moved to California for 3 months and worked at a recording studio, because I was like, I'm going to go be an engineer. And I realized, like, I'm not, I'm not an engineer. So as soon as I moved back to Oklahoma, I started booking like solo gigs. And my bass player, Michael, he's been playing with me like since high school in those garage bands.
Okay.
So really quickly, we were playing as an acoustic duo, like acoustic guitar.
And your first
and
album
upright
was
bass.
Both of your names, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You, were you not like thinking of yourself as a solo artiste in those,
really,
in those days?
That was, I was just trying to emulate a Blue Note album cover.
Nice.
And have
just everybody's name on there.
On the
There's
front.
Only two
yeah,
of us.
Exactly, exactly. But so for a long time we did like the house concert scene and did a lot of like, it wasn't necessarily solo shows, but it had that vibe of like, it's, you know, very intimate. And
I've
just
never done that house concert.
It's fun.
Tour, but it sounds really interesting.
It's interesting. I think that's a better word than fun for it.
Like I imagine the upside of it would be you'd play these cool houses and be kind of warm and welcoming and all that sort of thing, but the downside of it, and I'm just projecting here, would be like being trapped by crazy super fans.
that's kind of it, you know. And a lot of times, at least when we were doing house concerts, like I was really young, so I was like, yeah, we'll stay at your house, you know. And
right,
like, what that ends up meaning is like hanging out until really late and then like getting up and having breakfast with these people, you know, which is fine. It's
did
great.
Did you ever like wake up in the middle of the night and somebody was in your room staring
no.
at you with a knife?
nothing like that but
I'm gonna wear your skin, Parker.
But I've done a few like impromptu interviews at breakfast, you know.
Right,
it's like, oh, okay, now we're talking about my songwriting. Right. I haven't had coffee yet, y'all.
Yeah. It's a little early.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was like the what was I gonna ask you with the with doing solo gigs?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you enjoy about that's different than going out with a full band?
It's I haven't done a solo show in a long time. Like this little run that's coming up is gonna be a real like test. Like, can I still do this? I haven't done this in a minute.
Right.
I'm excited. I'm probably gonna do like the first half of the set. It'll be like two sets. First half, just solo acoustic guitar, which I like. You can play a lot with space, especially in a setting when everybody knows it's a solo show, nobody's talking. You can really leave lots of room, you know, which you don't always get to do with the band. I feel like my band's really good at that, but they're, you know, everybody's trying to make noise.
Right.
With the solo show, you can really space things out.
It's really interesting the how much the venue plays into that, I've found.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I played a little listening, like what they call a listening room,
right,
the other night, where it's just dead silent.
Yeah.
And that space thing really comes into play. But I've also played a lot of bars over the last couple months.
Yeah.
And we put like a couple hundred people in a bar, and everybody's drunk and swerving a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard with an acoustic to get over that.
It is.
Sound-wise.
It is.
You know?
It's like, it's a different challenge than with a band. Like, with a band, you can like, I don't know, like, oh, I got a really hot fiddle player, Dan. And so I can just be like, oh, Dan, when Dan takes his solo, like, people zone in. And then when it gets back to the quiet spot, I can do my thing. But when you're solo, it's like, well, I got to fill all this space. Like,
yeah.
Are they still into this?
As a guitar player, I mean, like, I like playing, like, a lot of lead guitar, and I can't do any of that, really, on a solo gig.
Definitely.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I do so much rhythm guitar that solo, luckily for me, feels kind of natural. Like, especially live, like I do some lead stuff, but it's mostly rhythm stuff.
Really? Because I read in your bio in preparation for this that
that
it listed like Clapton and Stevie Ray as like big influences. So I didn't know if you had. I've never seen you play live, so you know, you always live is where you kind of see what guys
are
doing.
The thing
you know?
Happen. Yeah,
yeah, you know. So I didn't know if you had like shred blues chops in your arsenal. You know,
no, my arsenal leans more towards like the like Lightning Hopkins riffs of like and then back to the rhythm,
rather
than like a blistering lead thing.
But you do a lot of nice finger style too, right?
Yeah, I play with a thumb pick, like even no matter what, pretty much I'm playing with a thumb pick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that way I can like switch between like a hard strum
yeah.
and then like a country finger picking thing. And I can also use my fingers for really quiet stuff when I
need
to.
I just had to get stitches in my
finger
this morning.
This morning?
This morning, yeah.
What?
I cut the hell out of my finger yesterday morning trying to open. We got some new kitchen knives. I was making breakfast and I was trying to open the package and the thing just jerked out and got me.
Oh man.
And one of I you're probably way too young to have kids yourself, but one of the great things about being a parent, what I've learned, because I have three boys, and
yeah,
we get stitches a lot, is that you can wait.
You have a tally on the wall.
Yeah, seriously, but like when you cut the hell out of yourself, you're like, nah, this can wait till tomorrow. Put a Band-Aid on.
Put a if you got a butterfly.
Yeah, yeah, this will be all right. Yeah. I'll just wait till tomorrow. Anyway, so but I have gigs this weekend, and I can't really bend it.
Yeah,
and now I'm like kind of like, oh man, what am I gonna do?
I got some thumb picks.
I wish I had thumb pick skills, man. Did you take a lot of lessons growing up to learn that, that style?
Sort of. I took lessons, just like really simple, where the lady taught me, you know, like basic scales and like a lot of praise and worship songs that are like G, C, and D.
Because you came up playing in church, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I grew up like, at church I was playing a lot of like old gospel hymns, not necessarily modern praise and worship, but then in guitar lessons I learned, you know, the basics for about 2 or 3 years from this lady, Donna Sherman. She was amazing. And then I took from a guy named Travis Linville, who we actually tour with now, and like he plays guitar with Hayes Carl, and
he's got Travis
songs.
In his name.
He's got Travis in his name. I know.
Finger style
and
skills.
I had never really seen somebody do that. To seeing somebody play with a thumb pick, and like the first lesson, I was like, "What's that thing on your hand?"
Right.
And he kind of explained it to me, and so I went and bought some thumb picks, and it took me so long to get to try and figure it out.
It's
like
really
a different
hard.
Instrument, trying to get the thumb independent. So, and I was in high school at the time, so I had one of those spiral notebooks, and I just took this bottom six spirals and I would space them out to like about guitar string spacing, and during class I'd keep my thumb pick and just like, you know,
on
the spirals.
Idea.
So I was like practicing finger picking patterns all through high school on my binder.
you need to like patent that. Start selling that at your shows.
The Parker Millsap guitar method.
Totally, man. That's
it just comes
that's
with a notebook
future.
And a thumb pick.
License that shit to Fender right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting listening to your music, because it, like, I would assume that playing music in church ultimately influenced your style and your songwriting and everything. And I don't know what kind of music, what the music sounded like that you're playing, but a lot of your music sounds to me like it's influenced by what I would think of as a much older, darker, sort of gospel-y tradition.
Yeah, you know? I was raised in a Pentecostal church, which is like...
Is that getting into some minor key, like crazy shit? Because that's where some of your music goes.
Yeah, like speaking,
you know?
In tongues the church that I grew up in was one of the more liberal of the Pentecostal churches in the South. But like we didn't do snake handling or anything like that.
Right,
But there was a lot of speaking in tongues, and the music service was like so much of going to church. It was like at least half of it was music. And in the Pentecostal church, it's this interesting thing that happens where sometimes it seems like the goal is almost for the preacher to not have to preach.
Right.
Not that he didn't want to, but like there's this, you know, there's like a, I don't even know how to go about describing it, but there's this system of like speaking in tongues and interpretation. And a lot of times how that would happen is just like revving the music up and then like, you know, start out with some hymns. And then by the end of 30 minutes, people are going insane, you know, speaking in tongues. And so I really opened up to like, oh, this is a deep power. Like this always happens during the music part.
Right.
You know,
right.
People don't speak in tongues during the sermon. People always get really worked up and like have these spiritual one-on-one connections with this greater thing during the music part. And I think really quickly, like I just latched onto that. I loved it. And I also love the congregational singing in church. Like
what is that?
Just like everybody singing together, singing hymns together. So much of the singing voices we hear today are heavily processed. Super processed, and they're perfect, you know, like we've figured out how to really engineer vocal takes to sound perfect.
It's a funny thing I've noticed, like if I'm watching somebody perform on TV or something with my wife, and my wife is not a musician, and I always kind of use her as a great, like she has none of the sort of like baggage that I have with it. She's done that strong opinions about it. She just take it in. She either likes it or she doesn't, you know, so she's a great person to like bounce that sort of thing off. But I notice if you see somebody singing live on TV, because we're all so accustomed to being so processed all the time, that even good singers singing pretty well live, my wife would be like, oh God, she doesn't sound very good, does she? Kind of thing. Where you're like, I don't know, it sounds pretty good to me.
That's what my monitors sound like every night.
Right. Oh, my monitors sound much worse, believe me. It is funny though. That is really, and now I tell you what, I see young kids because I go to, you know, there's a lot of like school functions where there's music stuff that I go to with my kids.
Yeah.
And it's the trippiest thing, man. You see live young people singing and like emulating auto-tune.
They emulate the auto-tune and it sounds like that.
Yes.
And they like naturally compress their voice.
Yes.
And it comes across almost like an accent sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's very
and that's
bizarre.
What we're used to hearing. But what I was saying about congregational singing is like in church, at least the church I went to, like everybody's singing all the songs. And so you're surrounded by these people who really are terrible singers, but they're not doing it to be good at singing. They're like doing it for this higher power, for a spiritual purpose. And so it comes across as really beautiful. And I just got used to hearing like kind of fucked up voices, but it's like, oh, that's great. Like,
right.
What a cool voice. There was this soprano singer at our church that had the most insane vibrato you've ever heard. Like it was a vibrato and a tremolo. And every service you'd hear, she sat right up front and it would just like bounce off that front wall and hit everybody else. But it was like this, you know, it's like sounds like a siren.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would hear that and be like, no, 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 that's bad. But I was like, oh, damn.
Listen
to that
right.
lady.
I think about that a lot with like great singers that you love. Like, it's so many of them have kind of really bizarre voices.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you did that yourself, like your friends that know you would be like, why are you doing that? Like,
yeah.
Why are you putting on that affectation? You know what I mean? But
yeah.
Like, you know, maybe somebody even like Mick Jagger or somebody that you you're just so accustomed to hearing them that you don't think twice about it.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is actually, you know, pretty
they're
effective.
Emoting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like that, I'm glad you mentioned Mick Jagger. He's one of my favorite singers. Like he's not the most perfect vocalist, but he emotes
and he
performs and like he's capable of taking his voice to different places. I love singers that can like make you cry and then make you laugh, like do the whole emotional range because that's what music's capable of.
Sure.
You know? Mick's great at that. Like being sassy and like, and then sound like an old man.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like that guy, those lyrics, he has to be 14 years old. Yeah.
I love when he sings like country and he puts on his Bakersfield accent and he does the whole thing.
The Stones
you know?
Doing country is some of my favorite country.
It's the best, I think that's probably why I like country music, you know?
Yeah.
Because I didn't grow up with country music. I grew up with Stones, you know?
Yeah.
That sort of led me.
It's funny, me too. I didn't grow up listening to a lot of classic country or anything. Like my dad had a big blues record collection. So I grew up listening to a lot of like Stones and Muddy Waters and.
Right.
Things like that.
That's more your primary influence?
Yeah.
Did you get into the country stuff later on?
Sort of. I still don't listen to a ton of country music. It's not my go-to. Like, what? I guess in some ways, like, a lot of the things I listen to are singer-songwriter. Like, I think of them as singer-songwriter, but to most people, they're country. Like, Lyle Lovett or Robert Earl Keane. These, like, Texas dudes.
Right.
You know?
That's the Oklahoma in you.
Yeah. But I've always been, like, into the blues. That's always been where my head's at.
Where in Oklahoma did you grow up?
I grew up just south of Oklahoma City, a town called Purcell. It's like 15 minutes south of Oklahoma City.
Okay, so is that like a suburb of...
I thought it was a suburb growing up.
until you moved to the big city.
Until I moved around a little bit and I realized like, oh no, that's rural. You know, that's not the suburbs.
I mean, maybe I'm projecting here just because of where you're from, but like, you know, who are some of you, like was Leon Russell an influence for you? Or some of the great like Oklahoma
I wasn't
people?
Aware of a lot of Oklahoma music until later on. I mean, I was aware of J.J. Cale and like, because of the Eric Clapton connection,
right? Because
he recorded a bunch of his songs.
Right.
And I was aware of Leon Russell, but it wasn't until I was like in my early 20s that I really started listening to all that. For whatever reason, it just didn't show up on my radar.
It's funny because I had read that you had performed with Elton John, so I didn't. I sort of like heard what I thought was sort of some Leon Russell influencing your music. So I didn't, you know, obviously those two have a connection, so I didn't know. I was wondering like how that Elton John thing came about, you know?
The Elton thing. It's one of those stories, like when I tell it, it's like, okay, this is going to sound like a bunch of name dropping weirdness, but this is what happened.
Right.
Roseanne Cash was at like some fancy person dinner party that Elton was at and had a copy of my record, I guess, and gave it to Elton or played some of it at the dinner party, something like that. And then like a month or two later, we got an email. John can confirm this, but we got like an email from his people basically like, hey, Elton likes the record. Do you want to come perform in London? And so I got to go play one of my songs with his band, like with Davy Johnstone and Nigel and everybody. It was crazy. And then one of his songs, with him, yeah, that was kind of insane.
Well, it's, I guess the thing that I'm kind of more interested in,
yeah,
because I've seen this sort of thing, you know, happen a million times. So it's right. Like when somebody like Elton John comes along, who's like superstar music veteran, you know,
yeah,
musician, and puts their sort of stamp of approval on you,
right,
in this case, or just any young artist, like what kind of, does that bring like some kind of unwanted pressure to you?
Because
there was a quote of his that was like, he said that you restored his faith in music. You know what I mean? That's pretty heavy, man.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
No, it's for me, the big thing.
You're like, slow down, Elton. Slow down, brother.
Give me a minute to get there.
I'm 25. Yeah.
the big takeaway with me and Elton, like, maybe there's some pressure. Really, there's not. I don't feel pressure like from Elton to like make the best record of all time or anything like that. But there was maybe a little bit of pressure to like try and capitalize on that.
Right, right.
Which is what it is. It's the music biz. Yeah. But I never, it doesn't really put pressure. For me, it's just like, oh, cool. Somebody else likes it. Like, it's, I try to think of it more like being respected by my peers than like anything else.
And you're not thinking about that next time you're in the studio going, oh my God, what am I going to do here?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I feel lucky that like this, I've put out like 6 or 7 records if you include all the stuff I did in high school.
Right.
So I'm starting to get used to that cycle and just like, just trust it.
I mean, you've made a bunch of records now. So are you,
yeah,
do you like being in the studio? Do you, cause you know, your records have evolved over the years and the latest ones sonically in a different, you know, pretty different place than like, if you go back to the first one, the Palisade.
Totally.
Is that a part of the whole creative process that you enjoy?
I love being in the studio. I just can't always afford being in the studio. I got to be on the road making money.
Right.
But I really like being in the studio and playing live.
Well, where did you make your latest record? And like, who produced it and all that sort of thing?
So it was produced by Gary Pachoza and Shawnee Gandhi. And then like I co-produced because I wrote the songs, I guess.
Right.
We did it at Echo Mountain in Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
It's this beautiful old church with like a Neve 80 series console. Ooh. And yeah, you know, beautiful, beautiful stuff. And then we did a bunch of the vocals and guitar overdubs at Gary's home studio there in Nashville. And Gary did...
In Asheville or Nashville?
Nashville. Sorry. Yeah,
okay,
we recorded in Asheville, North Carolina, and
Nashville.
Do you live
in Nashville
now? I live in Nashville.
You're Nashville based.
Yeah, yeah. I moved out there like 3.5 years ago or so.
Okay, so you were already into your career at that point.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, basically I was touring and that kind of thing.
Well, backing up a little bit, like how did you go from, you know, playing in church, playing in high school bands, that sort of thing, to making records? And presumably, did you get a record deal in there at some point?
Sort
or did you put your records out yourself? Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, well, the first 2 or 3 things that I put out, there was like no label involved. It was just like, one record I sold a guitar to like get the money to go pay for recording time, and then, you know, just pressed like 1,000 of them off CD Baby, and you know, there's like 2 or 3 of those records. And then I met up with David Macias from 30 Tigers at a Folk Alliance conference thing, and got the record deal, and their deal's a little different.
They're like a label services company, right?
Exactly. So they do like distribution, and they help their artists find, like, you know, publicity and publishers and booking agents and all of that kind of thing.
Is it kind of like running your own label in a sense?
Yes. I'm really lucky that I have really good management that helps me do all that. Nice. because there is a lot that goes on, that if it was left to me, like I wouldn't really know how to do it. There are like so many moving parts, and like I read the Donald Passman book. I know most of the rules.
Yeah,
you know?
Read that too.
I
read that like a million years ago. That's great. I'm glad that's still in circulation.
I'm really glad that I did.
I'm sure it's been updated quite a bit since 1990 or whatever it was.
It's probably
when I read
been updated since I read it like 4 or 5 years ago.
I still can't explain how a publishing deal works, but I did read that goddamn book.
I can't explain it, but like I can picture it in my mind, but when I go to try and put it in words and explain it to somebody else, they get that like glazed over look really quick. Yeah. Like, okay, you don't want to know about this.
So was there a point in all that when it's sort of like a sort of a specific moment you could even point to where you felt like, you know, maybe not like I've made it, but like, yeah, I'm doing this, I'm pulling this off. Like,
yeah, I mean, the big moment for me was like moving out of my parents' house. Right. You know, like I was working for my aunt doing like farm work and then doing music and like trying to convince my parents, like, it'll work. Like, I know I didn't go to college, but I can do music, I promise.
Yeah.
And they were great and supportive and let me live in the garage for like, you know, a year. And then once I could afford to move out and like pay my own rent for a second, like for me, that was it. Yeah. I was like, okay, I did it.
Yeah. No,
everything else is just icing.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I know. I have a similar moment in my, you know, mid-20s or whatever, when I had made a couple records. I finally paid off all my debt.
Yeah.
Like credit card debt that, you know, the creditors used to would call my house every day. And I paid off all my debt and I had a couple bucks in the bank. And I was kind of like, yeah.
this
working. Yeah, this is the best, man.
Yeah. No, it is the best. I really feel grateful. Like musicians... I just feel lucky. Like I get to move the air around in people's ears for a living, you know, like that's amazing.
Life.
And yeah. And I love music. I believe in music. It's like bigger than anything else to me.
Yeah. I read, in a couple things that your latest record is sort of referred to as like your rock and roll record, you know,
right.
A little more like, you know, good time record or whatever.
Right.
And it's funny, 'cause I think about it a lot, like Americana, you know, which is like obviously a big umbrella, if we can just
what
put you
it?
In it, you know, but it can be a very dreary genre, oftentimes,
definitely.
And very like sort of overwrought and very serious kind of thing. So
a lot of really sad white boys.
So was that like something you were consciously trying to move away from?
I think so. I think some of it was me consciously trying not to dredge up my own personal beefs with the world, maybe.
It's hard though, songwriting. I don't know how you feel about this, but like it's hard to write about, you know, happy subjects.
It's so hard.
It's so much more interesting generally to write about the dark stuff in the corners of your life, you know?
Yeah. For so long I idolized like the super sad songwriter guy.
Right.
And at a certain point in the past couple years, I don't know what triggered it, but I just kind of realized like, I'm not that sad. Like, I like my life, you know, like I like
kind of happy.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I like playing guitar as much as I like singing a sad song. So why do I got to try to be sad for these people? I don't.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
I grew up like my favorite movies were Rumblefish and The Outsiders.
Yes.
So
Tulsa.
And I didn't know that was shot in Tulsa. Yeah. You know,
and written by an Oklahoman and all that.
Right. Yeah. I didn't know any of that. I just, you know, loved, I read those books. I've watched the movies over and over and I loved them. And to this day, I mean, we were not that long ago, went through Tulsa and Oklahoma. And I always think about that when I'm there. And so I think I project that on Oklahoma, you know, the residue of Pony Boy.
It's just all greasers and socials.
Jerry Lee. Yeah. Like, were you aware of those books? Were you aware of that sort of that history and culture? I mean, I know it's not history.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
It's fiction,
but we read that book in, I think, all of Oklahoma schools. Like, you have to read
God,
The Outsiders.
Great.
Like,
yeah.
It's mandatory. Yeah. I don't know anybody who didn't read it who grew up in Oklahoma. It's great. I mean, we're aware of that for sure. And Essie Hinton, I think, is the author's name.
Yeah, yeah.
She's still active. She has a great Twitter. It's worth following.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's pretty sassy.
Okay. I didn't even realize she was still alive.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to definitely follow her. So you're going to go home, you're going to take a little break, do some solo gigs.
Yeah, do some solo gigs. Yeah.
Bunch of touring next year.
Hopefully. Yeah. I like touring. Yeah, it'll start back up in January, I think. Actually, we're doing a little run, we'll kind of ease into it. Nothing too intense until March or April, maybe.
Well, I'm going to be out there next year a bunch as well. Hopefully, we'll cross paths in Nashville a bit.
Sweet.
Yeah, and just out on the road, you know.
Hell yeah, that'd be great.
Doing it, so hopefully we'll run into you somewhere.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Did you, by chance, I don't even remember if I talked to your publicist about it, but did you bring a guitar? Did you want to play?
Oh,
some people do, some people don't. It's totally your call.
It's in the van. I don't know how far Steve and them are away. Are they close?
Oh, you don't need to.
Okay.
If they're gone, it's all good. But
we didn't even talk about guitar, man. That's like a whole two-hour interview.
Are you, well, why not dive into a little bit of that since the microphones are still running?
We can do a little bit.
Are you like a gear hound? Are you one of those gear people?
Sort of. I'm sort of a gear person. I don't look down on people. Like, I've recently bought a Squire Strat.
Right.
Cheap
right.
one. And I love it. Like, I don't think you have to have fancy gear to make amazing sure. music.
Yeah. That's an but expensive rabbit hole to go down.
It really is. And it like it keeps like you're into guitar and then you're like, oh, that sounds so good. And then you start to record it and you're like, oh, it doesn't sound. Now I got to get a preamp and a compressor and the right mic. Yeah, and it just keeps going.
Yeah, it's endless.
But yeah, I'm a small tube amp hound. Like they're, I keep
What's
going
your amp of choice? I've been looking for a vintage Princeton reverb.
Princeton? Late. See, I like champs. I've Ooh. Played a bunch of Princeton. We just we play so many small venues. That to get the amp to really do the thing and get it up to like 4 or 5 and then mic it up, the champ kind of makes more sense for the size of room.
I love
doing.
The champ just for its simplicity. One knob.
One knob. That's it. And the one I've got's a silver face, so it's got like
it's got a couple
a treble,
on there.
A treble and bass, but they don't do that much. Yeah. Like
I've got a beautiful, I don't remember what year it is, but I've got a little tweed champ.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do
great for recording.
They record so well. And and live, like I like low stage volume a lot of times, so it keeps it down. But
We talked about gear.
What else can we talk about gear? Flat wounds. Use flat wound strings. Try them out.
Right. Flat wound strings.
Especially if you're playing a hollow body and you're playing it through a small tube amp, put some flat wound strings on there. It'll splat. It'll like, grrr,
and
it'll do weird stuff.
If you're playing like a Tele or something through maybe a little bigger amp through like a Deluxe Reaver, that is some twangy shit with the flat wounds.
Oh, yeah. They get that.
Because somebody, I think it was my buddy Eddie that plays guitar in the Mavericks. I was asking him once, like a while ago, like, I go, man, I play a Tele through an old Deluxe Reverb Blackface. You know, I got the setup. And it just doesn't sound like, you know, Don Rich or those guys. It just doesn't sound right. And he goes, oh, you got to play flat wounds.
Yeah.
That's the trick. Because all those guys had flats back then.
Yeah, flats really do the thing. And like, I played acoustic guitar for so long that when I started playing electric, when I went back, like I had a Tele and I went back to the Tele and I couldn't do it. Like it was too like,
right.
So I started
using
aggressive
tone.
Yeah, with the round wounds. But then, like, I started putting flat wounds on everything, and the strings die. There's not as much sustain, which you know, if you're playing lead all the time, you don't want that. But for me, playing rhythm, it keeps it chunky. Like the note gets out of the way.
Interesting.
That's just my two cents.
I love it. People love even non-musicians. I feel like non-musicians almost the most love a deep dive on gear.
On gear.
It's the weird, you wouldn't expect it. It's the funniest thing, but there you go. Well, thanks.
My girlfriend would beg to differ.
Yes, as would my wife. Yeah. Thanks for coming down.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for having me, man.
All right, that was Oklahoma's one and only Parker Millsap. No acoustic performance today, but a wonderful deep dive on the gear. Make sure you get on over to walkinthefloor.com. I'm going to put a bunch of links up there so you can check out where he's at, stream his music, buy his tickets, buy his t-shirts, etc., etc., etc. And when you get done with that, get on over to chrisshiplettmusic.com. You can pre-order my new record, Hard Lessons, coming to you June 14th. You can get a bundle with a t-shirt, a bandana, some beautiful vinyl. It's going to be fantastic. I will be back in a couple of weeks with God knows who. I got to dig through my dusty old collection of unreleased interviews and see what we got. But that's it for this week. Adios, amigos!